Hi, this is Graham Atwell. Welcome you to the first edition of Emerging Sounds of the Bizarre in 2009. Funny, 2008 seems a long time ago. There's been so much going on. We've got another great programme lined up for you tonight. But before I go into that, let's give you details of the chat room where our host Christina Costa is waiting for you. Just go to http://tinyurl.com/sounds08. I'll say that once again. http://tinyurl.com/sounds08. Now back to tonight's programme. This is the second in our Dragon's Den special editions. Those who listened to the last programme will remember that Dragon's Den is part of the, it's coming up, JISC Users and Innovation Programme, Users and Innovation Design Model. Phew, what a mouthful, I was worried I was going to get that wrong. What does it mean? Well, the projects funded by the UK JISC Users and Innovation Programme are all about user-centred design and applications for learning Web 2.0. And the development model takes them through different stages of user-centred development. The Dragon's Den sessions were designed, I suppose, to help projects in self-evaluation and reflection through a kind of inquisition by critical friends. And then we thought it might be interesting to record some of these sessions and play them back on Sounds of the Bizarre. I have to admit I was sceptical about whether any of the projects would agree. But fair play, quite a number have put themselves into the Dragon's Den. I'm not actually quite sure how fierce the dragons are. More cute than fiery, I'd say. Tonight's show features two projects that are using Second Life for teaching and learning. The Moose Project and the Open Habitat Project. The dragons are Paul Bailey and Josie Fraser. Now, we recorded these sessions at Educa Online Berlin, so there's a bit of background noise, but it's not too bad. And after the projects pitch their wares and the dragons roar their fire, got a bit carried away with the script there, there's a chance for you to come in with questions and comments and issues, either through the chat or live through Skype. And we've got another great session lined up for you tonight. I haven't got this scripted, but it only came a few minutes before we went on air. We know we've got a lot of the wonderful people from Webheads here, and some of them are organising Earthcast this year, and we're going to have a quick session about what Earthcast is all about and how you can get involved. But we'll go over to the Moose Project in just a minute. First, though, a couple of shout-outs. There's an increasing number of free and open online courses being launched almost every day, it seems. One of these is the Multiliteracies course being, I think, hosted by Vance Stevens as part of the EVO programme. And Christina Costa was supposed to be presenting to them tonight. But they decided, thank you very much, they decided she could stay with us in the chat room and they'd come on over to the programme. So welcome to you all, hope you enjoy it. And we'd love it if some of you come on a bit later and tell us what Multiliteracies is all about. Oh, and another shout out as well to the fantastic Ziggy Jacob and to Andreas Aufwater, who helped us do the sound checks about half an hour ago. Well, that's quite enough for me at the moment. Now, the Plattermeister, that's a good word, isn't it? The Plattermeister, he's staring at me, Dirk Steerglitzer, is the Plattermeister, I'll say it again, is going to spin his turntables now, or rather his iPod. And after a very short musical break, we'll be back with the Moose Project. Okay, you've got the idea. Let's go. Introductions, please.
So I'm Julie Salmon, Professor of E-Learning and Learning Technologies at the University of Leicester. I head up the On Distance Research Alliance, which underpins our strategy for e-learning development in the university and has four quadrants to it. And we're going to talk today about Moose, which is one of the animals in our media zoo. Media zoo is the operational area of the strategy. It has three parts to the zoo: a physical space where staff can come and play around with technologies, a virtual space where we disseminate the outcomes from all our research projects, and also a virtual space in our Second Life Island.
I'm Palitha and I'm working as a lecturer at Beyond Distance with Jilly and the team.
Hi, I'm Ming Nie. I'm the research associate in e-learning at Beyond Distance Research Alliance and work with Jilly and Palitha.
Okay, that's the introductions over. Now Jilly, what's the Moose project all about?
So around 18 months ago, we decided we wanted a dissemination space in Second Life. So we bought a little island and we worked with a company called 2-4, who are a media production and TV company. And we've got a very nice zoo now in Second Life on that island. And we have four quadrants in there. One area is Pet's Corner, where we work with existing technologies and safe things. And you can actually pet the technologies there without them biting you. We also have an area called Safari Park, where we're exploring where our technologies and pedagogies are going out to new missions, markets and countries. For example, we are a community of expertise in distance and mobile learning with the UN. So Safari Park is the area to have a look if you want to know more about that. In addition, we have the area where we've mentioned podcasting and mobile learning and so on. That's another area in the zoo. That's got wolf and impala and a range of other animals in there. And of course, we've also got the area which is looking over the horizon, which we call the exotics house, where the animals are slightly more dangerous and a bit more risky to handle. And we should report that moose is in there. So moose is in the slightly more risky and dangerous area of the media zoo. However, we have managed to secure some very interesting projects to test out and to see what extent the moose that we're working with can be tamed. So I'm going to hand you back to Palitha and Ming, who will now describe some of the activities on the Second Life Island for the moose project.
Now hold on a moment, Jilly. I don't mind you talking about wild animals. I'm supposed to have a couple of wild dragons here. They seem to have gone to sleep. We're supposed to be asking the questions here. I'll just have to take over. Could you tell me about some of the activities you've undertaken in the Moose Project?
On the Second Life Island, in terms of the Moose Project, we have created two activities with two distinct modules. One is to do with distance learning for archaeology. The other is to do with digital photography for undergraduate students. Two different universities. The activities with regard to archaeology is we are doing with the University of Leicester, and the other activity we are doing with South Bank University in London. So Ming was working mainly on developing the activities and researching. So perhaps Ming can explain the activities more.
Okay. Well, with the archaeology students, we mainly developed two artifacts. One is called a Sami tent to simulate the lifestyle of Sami people lived in North Scandinavia. And previously, the teaching of the use of landscape and space was largely dependent on text-based material and two-dimensional photos and diagrams and that kind of two-dimensional things. And now we replicate a Sami tent in Second Life, so students can go inside out and they can see and touch the artifacts, and as well as to try where they can go and where they can't, according to their gender role. And the other artifact we developed is a Kalasha village to replicate the lifestyle of Kalasha people living in northwest Pakistan. The purpose is the same. So previously, the teaching of Kalasha culture and their social practice is largely dependent on text-based material. And now we have the chance to replicate a Kalasha village in Second Life in a three-dimensional world. So students can explore the village and they can see the buildings and they can try where they can go and where they can't according to their gender role. With the digital photography students, we use a different approach. And the approach is we firstly teach them how to create a story cube. And then we teach them how to change the size, move it around, and how to put pictures on each side of the cube. And then they were set out to visit different places and islands in Second Life and to collect digital images in relation to subcultures. And when they come back and they put up their digital images on each side of the cube and tell a story.
The moose has intimidated the dragons. They're still sleeping. I'll ask the questions. Where'd you get the pedagogical models for the project from?
It's been small-scale projects, and that's been quite deliberate. Now, for example, I've been using a five-stage model of scaffolding and a framework for student activities for some years, but they were all developed for text-based environments. Now, one of our intentions with the Moose project was to find out whether these were helpful for socialisation of students in quite a different environment and whether it helped them to work together more productively for learning. In fact, they have been extremely helpful, have saved us completely reinventing the wheel. We've been able to do Second Life moderator training as opposed to e-moderator training, and that's helped the teachers to be more confident. And we've now got the student induction down to about 1 hour with materials and some in-world events.
Ming, can you tell us something about the research methodologies you've used on the project?
I think we collect evidence from both the tutors and students who participated in SLEETivities. And we did interview with both tutors and students. Also, we kept a chat log through each of the ETVT sessions. And we also observe, take research notes based on each of the in-world session. And that's the data, the method for data collection. And we use a new research methodology, which is called cognitive mapping, and which guide our research design right from the beginning. And the cognitive mapping methodology is good at to collect a personal view, and especially when people using new things to collect their personal view and their change of view over the time. So at each of the interview, we would be able to display a personal a student's personal view on their use of Second Life and through a graphical way.
I'm impressed. How can we find out more about it? Can I have a look at the project myself?
Yes, Media Zoo is open for public, for anyone to come and visit, and on Second Life Island as well. So a lot of the artifacts that Ming and Jilly mentioned are available in Media Zoo, the Samiten Kalasha village, and also the story cubes that were developed by London students. So you can come and visit the Media Zoo and explore, as well as look at the deliverables, things like guidelines for students and staff that we have developed.
At last, the dragons are waking up. Josie's got a question.
I've got a question to all of you, really, but whoever is most appropriate, please do answer it. Induction times. You're saying that you've got the induction time down to an hour. Second Life and induction times doesn't usually seem to me like a very easy thing to carry out in an hour's time. So how are you managing to get people up and running in Second Life in an hour? Or are there kind of pre-activities that they're doing before they come into the environment?
Right, for both staff and students, we have YouTube-based materials for them to watch. For staff, we found it was best to have them in the physical media zoo, so we had them with us for confidence building. With students, they were entirely remote and we didn't find that necessary. And then we have our media zookeeper, who's not here today, but he's very experienced at helping people get the basic skills of Second Life, and we find these are movement controls and camera controls, and we find if people have those two basic skills, which can be taught in under an hour in world with an experienced facilitator, then that's more than they need.
Josie's getting bolder. She's in with another question.
We've got quite a few projects working around issues of digital identity. Have you got any things coming up in terms of, well, actually, I would like my avatar to look this way, or are you supporting people in becoming autonomous in world, as well as just being able to move around, being able to develop themselves and their avatars?
I think we got two different group of students, and one is the distance learners and the other one is campus-based students. And the campus students is quite interesting because they are second year and they know each other for about a year. So they know each other and they can simply tell who is the person behind the avatar simply from the appearance of the avatar or how the avatar behaves in group work. And when they talk to each other through the avatar, they actually think they are dealing with the real person, not through the avatar. With the distance learners, it's also interesting because they think Second Life can help them to build up relationship faster compared to asynchronized text-based discussion forum, because there is a social presence through the avatars. But however, compared to face-to-face, and they deeply inside, they know when they talk to the avatar, they are not dealing with the real person.
And now the question I've been dying to ask all the way through this program.
Why is moose a dangerous animal?
Our approach at Leicester is very much this, that we want to use stable technologies that are available to all students and staff in the university to improve pedagogical processes. But at the same time, we want to also look to the future and start to explore all the new technologies that are coming about. And in that sense, the lack of a pedagogical model when we start makes it more risky. So that's why we prefer to do small-scale research with the new up-and-coming unproven technologies and large-scale research with stable things like VLEs. And moose at the moment fits into the up-and-coming. We do also have a process that transfers dangerous animals to Pets Corner. This is our innovation to practice process in the university. And this involves, for example, getting staff development on board, making sure everyone's got access to the technology, ensuring the help desk staff and so on are there to help. So it's very much part of an agreed process in the university for scaling up. And we only do that when we've got stable pedagogical models.
You'll remember at the start, I said we had two dragons. And here's the second, it's Dragon Paul. Come in, Paul.
Are you saying that these dangerous animals are new pedagogies or activities for which you haven't yet found a pedagogical model that fits?
Well, both really. They're generally what we've got on in the more risky areas of the Exotics House are new technologies, typically those actually that have not been developed for pedagogical purposes. So these would be the personal devices, student-owned devices, new Web 2 areas that have been developed for other reasons other than learning and teaching. It's then our responsibility to develop the pedagogy. But as explained for Moose, we're finding pedagogical frameworks that we have developed in other technological environments are transferring pretty well, and that's saving us time and effort.
Can you say something about the importance, or not importance, of how you feel about having all of these activities going on in the same area at the same time? What's the benefits? Are there benefits?
Okay, the benefits of having all these activities going on, at least in one area, are that it underpins the university's strategy. the four quadrants of the zoo reflect the four quadrants of our e-learning and pedagogical innovation strategy, and that means that we've got overall support throughout the university, both from academic departments and from all the corporate service units. So the Media Zoo is very much an underpinning and implementation area, an area critically providing research evidence for change.
So does this model also guarantee sustainability of these activities once the funding runs out at the end of March 2009?
Right. As much as anything is guaranteed in the current global economic climate, yes. In a way, it's a decision point. At the end of the project, we take a cost-benefit decision as to whether it is worth sustaining it, whether it is going to add long-term value. My belief that Moose is actually going to bring massive long-term value from what is essentially a small demonstrator project, both for us and for others who can adopt the processes.
Pause on a roll now.
And how will the lessons and knowledge be exchanged, passed on to the wider sector, other institutions?
Yeah, I think the primary apparatus, if you like, is the Media Zoo, because we have all the artifacts and the experiences, case studies are available there. So that's one way of disseminating through within the university and outside the university. The other way is we've got an annual conference coming up, usually in January, and this year it's on the 8th of January. So there is input from our Moose project and other projects into the the activities of the day as well. So that's another way. And also we have we are working with the Podcasting for Pedagogical Purposes group, special interest group. So that's another way. And also Emerge community as well.
I suppose other areas are, I mean, critically, I think it's critical to build on a starter project like this in other projects. So Ming's already mentioned that the Duckling project, which is a curriculum design project, working with two different partners, to not archaeology, a different area, in the university, education and psychology this time. So always transferring from one discipline to another, working with different academic partners, so that it's built upon, and because there's always 101 more things to research and to develop. And also the strategy at Leicester is being revised at the moment. So it's also informs, if you like, policy and strategy decision making. Hopefully divert some more resources our way too.
We can't say that the dragons didn't try. And Josie got a few questions in at the end. But really, the Moose team was just too good for them. They've done this sort of stuff before. They knew what they were going to say, and they made sure they'd say it. But it's day two. The dragons have got another chance. This time up, it's Dave White with the Open Habitat Project. Let's ask him to do an introduction.
I'm Dave White from Technology Assisted Lifelong Learning, and I was the kind of principal investigator stroke project manager. I'm never quite sure exactly where to pitch that for the Open Habitat project, which was funded through the Users and Innovation strand of JISC and supported by Emerge. And we were looking at using multi-user virtual environments for teaching and learning. And we did that by piloting with two distinct groups of students. On the one hand, we had art and design undergrad students based at Leeds Metropolitan University. And they could meet face-to-face. They were on a traditional undergrad degree. And on the other side, we were piloting with students, lifelong learners, distance students, who had been on short online distance philosophy courses based out at the University of Oxford. So two distinct groups, which meant that the project had a kind of natural kind of breadth to it. It was also quite nice, because of the way that the project team came together through the kind of Emerge sort of pre-bidding process, it meant that we were working with Ian Truelove and Graham Hibbert, who are both lecturers at Leeds Met University, and I was working with Marianne Tolbert, who's the director of our online distance philosophy courses. And all of these people came to me saying, I think that these environments like Second Life are going to be of value in teaching for different reasons. So if you like, the project was a reaction to teaching practitioners saying, well, how can we get into this stuff? Because we think it's going to be valuable. We're not sure exactly how or why or where it fits, but how can we get into it? And that's how the project came together. So it had quite a natural genesis, if I can use that word.
And yes, the dragons are on the ball today. Josie's straight in now.
So you, the project is, you're framing it in terms of MUVEs, multi-user virtual environments, but you're mainly using Second Life?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, we've used three different MUVEs. We've used Second Life, we've used OpenSim, which is an open source version of Second Life, which is used extensively on the art and design side of the project as a kind of, as a way of inducting people to the whole kind of scene of MUVEs in a safe place, because you can provide them with their own island, so it becomes a single user virtual environment for a while. They can get their head around building, they can get their head around moving around, and what that does, what that did quite nicely was that Ian Treelove designed these nice sort of workshop way into the area using OpenSim. And then when we made the transition into Second Life, the students didn't have to deal with lots of issues at once, okay? So we'd separated out the kind of almost mechanical side of you know, the nuts and bolts things that you have to learn from the socialization side. Because as soon as you get in Second Life, there are other people in there, they've got better hairstyles than you, you get a bit self-conscious. And it was true, as soon as we put those students into Second Life, we lost them for about an hour to fiddling around with their appearance and getting slightly freaked out by the other people in there. But then when we drew them back together again on the Leeds Met Island, they had this kind of kind of foundation of skills that they got from OpenSim, which was like a safe place. So that was one of them. The other one is Wonderland, which comes out of Sun. And we haven't used that directly for piloting, but we've assessed it. And the Wonderland platform seems to be very good for like collaborative professional working, because it seems to be based, it is based more around sort of document, collaborating on documents. So you can put a Word document in there and chat about it as you type. So for us, it wasn't so directly useful for our particular student groups, but we could see it has a useful place within the field.
Can I ask you a question, mainly about Second Life, but obviously it also covers and refers to the use of Wonderland platform. These are third-party commercial endeavours. They're not owned by your institution. They're run as businesses online. Can you tell me something about how you manage the risk management process?
We use Second Life mainly because it was kind of top of the pile when we started the project. But even when we put the bid in, we said, look, by the end of this project, the whole thing's going to change, and it has done. So if you like, the risks are mitigated into the future because of the expansion of the area, and you won't have to use Second Life. So within the project, yes, there are those risks, but in terms of what the project means and you know, going forwards, we'd sort of see that, you know, you could pick and choose environments as appropriate.
Good answer, Dave. You managed that one well. And now Paul's waking up.
So how much of the investment that's gone into this has gone into develop the learning activities in the environment specifically? And how much of it do you think is learning that is transferable elsewhere?
Some of the stuff that we're starting to write up now has the word Second Life in it. But if you look at it closely, you can remove the word Second Life and the principle still stands. So I'm quite confident that Second Life has been just an exemplar. All of the principles and ideas and models and designs or whatever you want to call them that come out of the project, very few of them are linked specifically to that platform. A lot of the piloting took place in the platform, but the ideas are transferable, even if the prims aren't. So,
what about the time taken for the individual learners to develop skills to be able to function, learn and operate in these environments?
Well, again, I think a lot of those skills are quite generic, you know. If you can build in one of these environments, you can build in another. If you can fly in one, you can fly in another. I don't think we've tracked them in Second Life, because a lot of what they've been learning about, in the same way that a lot of what we've been generating and what we hope to generate out of the project is transferable, I think their skills are quite transferable as well.
And yes, the dragons are much more lively today. Josie wants more details.
Can I ask you a question about the two distinct populations that you've involved in this project? Did you notice a split between those two different populations?
Well, I think to be fair, you know, both groups were slightly self-selecting. Certainly on the philosophy side they were. But with the art and design, you know, the way that that art and design undergraduate degree works is that they present the students with lots of different services and environments and tools, and the ones that they're interested in, they pursue. That's the kind of pedagogy. So Ian put about 150 students through his Open Sim induction, and then got about 20 students who wanted to take that on further that he worked with. So he knew he had people that were keen, but they certainly weren't experienced. And, you know, just because they were younger and because they worked in art and design didn't mean that they were any more comfortable with the environment. And to sort of support that on the philosophy side, some of the philosophy students, you know, they were bumping into things a little bit. They had trouble sitting down. People really want to sit down. Yeah, they were insistent that we put good seats in, and they hated sitting down facing the wrong way. I'm still trying to work out what that means. But a couple of the students, three of the students that came on the first phase of the philosophy pilot, they liked it so much that they started up their own philosophy group called Second Philosophy in Second Life. And every Sunday evening throughout the course of the project and ongoing, they convene a philosophical debate around a topic on the Open Habitat Island. You know, and so that was as a result of just coming on the pilot. So,
can I ask, if your student population and the students that you spent time with, you've obviously had great success with them, they've gone on to do their own kind of autonomous work within the environment, but they're a self-selecting group, so how scalable is your project, or is it a question that this would only meet a kind of personalised learning need where there is the room and the resource to offer that kind of choice?
Well, if you want to get the best out of teaching and learning in these kind of environments, it's better to do it with a small group of students, because what it seems to do best is the tutorial, seminar, workshop style paradigm. Once you get a lot of people into something like Second Life, one of these MUVs, and I don't think it's the environment, I think it's the underlying communication principle, which is that if you've got a lot of people and one person you're trying to impart knowledge, it always ends up as a lecture. You know, and this is what we see. Once you get more than about 15, 20 people in Second Life, ultimately it kind of becomes a lecture. And I think that there's a question there as to whether there's a way of breaking that cycle, whether there are ways of teaching in these environments that allow you to teach with large bodies of students without just replicating the lecture format. Now, I can't say that we've figured out what that is, but what I would say is that I think that this stuff is always going to be niche, and I think that what it's good at is the sense of presence and the interpersonal communication, collaboration, cooperation, whatever you want to call it, and that always works better in smaller groups.
Yes, the dragons are on the ball today. They want to know all the details.
So how many learners have you actually been involved in your pilot?
I'd say probably somewhere between 150 and 200. With the largest body of students going through Ian Truelove's, you know, 3-hour long open sim based induction. I'd say that our core group was probably about somewhere between 20, 30 students, maybe a little bit more than that, but we have put this in front of a significantly larger body of students.
And now the dragons are going for it. Josie asks a very hard question.
What do you think about, what kind of percentage, if you even put it in those terms, is the division between formal and informal learning outcomes for your learners?
In the MUVEs?
Yes.
On the philosophy side, in the second phase, we had a Moodle in the background. So if you like, the Moodle had a forum in it and it led up to the Second Life bit. And then we had a very intense time in Second Life and then we led away from it. So we took the chat log out, the tutor annotated it and posted it back into the Moodle so that they could reflect. Okay, so if you like, on the philosophy side, the Second Life portion was the informal bit of a larger process that included formal elements of Sermic, so we placed it in a larger slice of learning. From the point of view of the art and design side of things, to us non-art and design people, it all looks informal. And I'd say that a lot of what went on in Second Life on that side of the project we'd think of as informal, but that's a reflection of the overall degree.
Josie's got a clause out now. What, she asks, is the value, the added value, of informal learning in Second Life for students coming on a formal course? Can't they just stay at home and do it?
This is a major sort of juncture that we've come to. It seems to me that these environments work very well where the knowledge, and to quote Dave Cormier, is a moving target, okay? So in disciplines where the knowledge is negotiated, you know, meaning is negotiated, so you're not tending towards a specific answer. There is no right answer. But it's the process of discussion and collaboration, the ability to be able to informally, you know, relate to your peers and your tutor, to be able to move the knowledge forward collaboratively, that's kind of what the subject is. So when you think about it, with art and design, it was fortunate that we were working with those disciplines. With both art and design and philosophy, the process is the learning. You know, that informal process is the learning. And I think if anybody came on an undergraduate degree or a course of at almost any level in those disciplines and expected to be told the right answer, well, they've kind of turned up to the wrong place, haven't they? So one of the major findings out of the project for me is just how important that is in terms of these spaces. And this is probably why computer scientists and mathematicians generally seem to be uncomfortable with it, because they're less likely to see the value in that informality.
Well, that's let the pigeon out the bag, hasn't it? All the dragons started talking at once. I've had to edit out their questions. But Dave's definitely on the defensive now. Listen to this.
Listen, I'm not trying to say that there are creative and non-creative disciplines.
So you're saying that there are certain disciplines that wouldn't benefit from engagement with multi-user virtual environments?
There are certain pedagogies in certain courses that would just see them as inconvenient. And I'd agree, they would be very inconvenient for them. I think sometimes it comes down to the teaching practitioner as much as the discipline. If the teaching practitioner in question sees the value of that informal, discursive route to understanding and learning, then, you know, there's probably a role for these environments. If they don't, then they're just like, well, why are there all these pictures? Why are people walking around as avatars? And it's just not going to be the right thing for them.
So you've come to the end of your pilot phase.
Yes.
What's next? Is that it?
What's next is we've got a lot of, I believe the term is sense-making to do. We've got to work out what we've just done. I mean, obviously we've been doing that as we go along, but I think there's a lot. We've got a lot of data in terms of things like video, screenshots, chat logs. So, yeah, everybody's got a lot of this stuff. But we're cherry-picking concepts out of that. And what we want to do is what I'm really keen to do is to link our outputs to the community through to our primary data. It's also important in this particular area because the character and the texture of the of what happens in MUVEs, which is sometimes a little bit chaotic, it's important that that comes through in what we're saying. But because we work with teaching practitioners right from the start of the project, it was kind of naturally embedded, certainly on the art and design side of things. So Ian Truelove and Graham Hibbert will just literally be running this year on year and expanding it. And they became more confident with the idea of the potential to run an entire MN focused around an MUV. Philosophy side, in terms of sustainability, it's a little bit more tricky because with online distance courses, if there's a piece of learning which is kind of mandatory to the course, then that has to take place in an environment that everybody can get into. So in some senses, online distance learning can become a bit of a lowest common denominator technologically. So I'd see the sustainability of it as probably being more of a social space than necessarily where discussion can take place. But it's not officially part of the curriculum.
Josie goes for the kill.
Do you not see work in this area as being elitist, as being unaccessible to a lot of students who maybe don't have fantastic computers, they don't have good internet access?
Yes, it is. It is. I mean, ultimately it is. But the way that I look at that is that it's our job in the project to look into, you know, next generation environments. Now, if everybody can do it, they're not next generation. They're this generation. So I make no apologies for that. And if you know, in 1995, hardly anybody could do email. And now we don't even ask students if they've got an email. So I think that the environments will remain niche in pedagogical terms, but that people's technological ability to get into them, that issue will fall away. And whenever you see a new high-end technology kind of come on stream, there's always that discussion. And then a few years later, everybody's like, well, the iPlayer. Think about the iPlayer. Nobody says, you know, well, there's some people that can't get it, what a tragedy. But if they started out 5 years ago, anyway, you know what I'm talking about.
Good answer, Dave. You did well there. But there's no respite. Paul's leaping in now.
We all know that a funded project always helps to build a community of interest around what you're actually doing. Have you thought how you're going to keep servicing and sustaining that community beyond the funding?
Well, I think that ultimately it'll be through personal contacts and staying in touch with the people that we've been doing the project. There's no doubt that we will be continuing to move these ideas forward, whether they're funded or not. I think the question is how that goes beyond the people, you know, the core set of people. And, you know, iBlog, Dave Cormier blogs, Ian Treelove blogs, Steve Wharton blog. There's a question there as to whether reading blogs and commenting on blogs or that kind of activity could be considered a community or not. But we're all kind of immersed in that kind of form of communication anyway. So it's not as if we're going to write a final report, make it into a PDF, stick it on a website somewhere, and then all disappear. Because we're kind of in that sort of flow anyway. So I think what we want to do now is to get our findings out there to encourage people to take this on. So what I'd like to be able to do is to take what we've learned and put it out there in a variety of forms, so that people, when they're considering using these spaces, will be aware of what the issues are, so that you can manage your way through some of the cultural as well as pedagogical issues.
Time's running out, but Joseph's still got questions to ask.
So given that you're only giving your students an hour to sort out their hairstyles, are you placing enough emphasis on actual digital identity and how that is managed by the learner?
Well, in terms of moving forwards, I mean, that's an area that I think that would be very useful to look into. And not even, I mean, but perhaps in a way that's broader than simply MUVEs, because I think when you talk about digital identity, you can't just lodge it in a single type of environment. And I do personally think that that concept of digital identity is becoming ever more important. And if you like, the MUVE is the sort of apex. You can really see that challenge. I mean, literally see it in MUVEs. But nevertheless, the challenge goes throughout, you know, all of the different environments that we use when we're doing e-learning.
Bring me a real solution. You just bring me a real solution. You call yourself United Nations. United Nations. Like conditions without conviction.
Sounds of the Bazaar. You're listening to Sounds of the Bazaar, Emerging Sounds of the Monday, with your host, Graham Atwell. We hoped you enjoyed hearing Jilly talking about wild animals. We hope you enjoyed Dave talking about open habitat. We certainly had a lot of fun talking to them in Berlin. But now into the second section of the programme. And whilst you've been listening, we've been doing some pretty frantic setting up last-minute productions on who's going to come on tonight. And I'm delighted to say I've got Vance Stevens online to talk to you about that multi-literacies programme that I alluded to in the introduction. Vance, welcome to Emerging Sounds of the Bazaar.
Well, thank you very much.
Where are you based, Vance?
Well, I'm in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates.
Okay. Well, can I ask you, first of all, what is multiliteracies?
Oh, that's a good question. It's, literacy, of course, when people think of literacy, most people think of print literacy, but multiliteracies starts from a treatise done by the New London Group, a group of people who got together and developed this concept back in 1996. So it's over 10 years old, and there's been quite a lot of attention paid to it, which is basically how to teach sort of 21st century learning style, you know, how to get students to be able to communicate in a world that is not necessarily print. Print's very important, but there are so many other aspects to it. Like what you're doing right now, for example, is a very good example of multiliteracies.
So it's using audio, using visual. I often wonder if we're actually not moving into a more visual world today.
Well, I'm sure we are. I thought a really good example of multiliteracies was a little screencast you put together where you used SlideShare and you had videos in that SlideShare. Do you remember that? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I'd like to know how you did that.
It's a long story. I don't know if I can even remember myself how we did. Oh, yes, I do. That's Dirk Steerglitz, who's multi-literacies himself. I mean, he doubles up in producing that video. It was actually done using the Apple presentation software. Dirk also doubles up as our producer on this radio program, so I guess that is an example of the skills we use today. Anyway, what's the multiliteracy course that you're running?
Okay, I'm just pasting the link to that in the chat room. I hope it pastes. Funny, it didn't paste. Anyway, I'll try to do it later. Okay, the multiliteracies course is part of the EVO, or Electronic Village Online sessions, which are run by TESOL. They're actually run by grassroots. They're a grassroots effort. And here, I just got that link in the chat room now. So cool. This is a very good example of multiliteracies. This
of
is what we're talking
we're,
about.
We'll put the link into the program notes for those who listen after this program.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a good example of, you know, how to communicate in a multiliterate world. And this one has lots of visuals, lots of video, sounds. Of course, sounds of the bazaar. You do quite a nice program here. I'm sort of a podcast addict. I listen to podcasts. I drive to work 45 minutes every day and 45 minutes back, and I always enjoy that drive because I've got my iRiver in my ear, and I learn quite a lot. So basically, we're trying to, you know, on the theory that teaching is modeling, and also in the theory that your information resides in your personal learning network, we are modeling how people can use these technologies to teach one another how to use them. And then, of course, some of that should trickle down to students eventually.
Well, I think that's great. I mean, one of the things I've been talking about is the need for actually teachers and learners to take over the technologies, not to just leave it to the educational technologists to provide them for us. And I think that's beginning to happen, Doug.
Yeah. In this course we're running, our fifth week is going to be about EduPunk, which is kind of on that topic. And it's basically where you're hitting walls, you know, that you can't do what you'd like to do exactly with technology, so you just do it, you know, and never mind the technology people, we are the technology people. So there's a link to that section on EduPunk.
I think that's a great slogan. Never mind the technology, we are the technology people. You heard it here on Sounds of the Bazaar, Emerging Sounds. Vance, thank you so much for coming on the program. We're going to have to go now because my producer's waving at me. We're running out in time. We're going to go into a musical break now. We're going to try and come back with an item on Earthcast. We're trying to get a few people online together, which is always a bit of a challenge, but we'll see how it goes. Thanks, Vance, and I hope we'll have you on the programme again in the future.
Cheers.
Okay, into the musical break. The Bazaar Live Internet Radio, bringing to you the best in educational technology ideas, learning and teaching and everything else. Now here's a bit of a minor technological miracle, I think, in that short musical interval. Andreas Outhwaite has managed to delve me in with Doug Symington, Matt Montaigne, all of them talking to you tonight about Earthcast. Matt, can you explain to us what Earthcast is about?
Well, sure. Before I do that, Graham, I just wanted to compliment you and the Sounds of the Bazaar community on a wonderful production. I'm so impressed by your techniques, but also the great conversation today. So again, my compliments.
Half an hour behind the show, we were sweating still, Matt.
okay. Well, I just want to thanks again for having me on here to talk about the Earthcast. Earthcast is just a it's part of the World Bridges community, and what we do is we work together as a community for about 3 or 4 months leading up to Earth Day, which in 2009 is on April 22nd, and our goal is to host a live 24-hour conversation about all things environment. So we hope to have people take an hour-long block of time to moderate a conversation about a topic of their choosing, and it really does have a international flavor as well. Last year, Earthcast 2008, we had people joining in and participating from all over the place, from Europe to South America to North America, and we hope to continue to expand our project during 2009.
And I actually listened in last year and was hooked. I started out thinking I was going to listen to half an hour of it because I was really busy and I just couldn't turn it off. It was wonderful. Doug, what's the problems in hosting something like this?
Some of the problems are probably the same ones that you encounter with your show in terms of the production and making sure that everybody is up to speed and connected with headphones instead of speakers, and some of the mechanics involved, and also in terms of reconciling time zones around the world is something of a challenge. But by the same token, a very great activity, in fact, that it does increase one's frame of reference, and it lets us know that many of us are able to do time conversions in our head after a couple of sessions along. But I think that the best part for me is the ability just to connect with people around the world, and we were particularly enthused by the number of student voices that we were able to include in the conversation last time, and hope to do that again.
Yes, that's pretty fantastic, isn't it? Listening to some of those kids last year, they were just so articulate. Andreas, you've got involved in it, haven't you? Tell me what you're going to be planning to do with Earthcast this year.
Well, this year the planning isn't still as far as it should be, it could be, but I want to say something different. I would like to invite all the listeners who are in contact with school classes, with student classes in universities, especially in the Japanese or Asian or African or Arabic regions, we have some missing white spots. Would like to bring you on.
And I don't know who's the person, Matt, perhaps. If people want to get involved in it, if we got teachers, schools, anybody listening to this who wants to get involved in Earthcast, how can they do that?
That's a good question, Graham. We have a couple different ways for those people to connect with us. One, they can send us an email at earthbridges@gmail.com. And I'm also sticking a link to a wiki that we use as to plan the event, and that's at earthbridges.wikispaces.com. And we also have another address, and that's earthbridges.net. So one of those methods will help folks who want to participate get involved. And another thing, too, this can seem like a moose, so to speak, this project. This can seem very scary, to use the metaphor that that was brought up earlier in the sounds. But really, the Earth Bridges community, our goal is to make it as easy as possible for people to participate. So we can even have people participate. We can have classes and students participate via cell phone if that's what they want. Likewise, if people do want to learn some of the technical aspects of live streaming and webcasting, the community will support that effort as well.
And Doug, what do you hope comes out of this sort of event?
My hope would be that young people recognize that they do have the ability to make an impact. I think we saw a little bit of that last year in terms of empowering youth especially and everybody with regards to the environment in terms of the notion that we're all in this together and there's a lot that each of us can do locally and it's really nice to be able to collaborate globally.
Okay, thanks to the three of you. I'm running very short on time. We'll certainly be supporting Earthcast. We'll certainly be publicising it, and I'll be back in touch personally because I've got a couple of schools who want to participate. Thanks for coming on the show, and we hope to talk to you more about it on a later show. Okay, you're listening to Emerging Sounds of the Bazaar. We're going to run into another musical break now, and when we come back, I hope I'm going to be talking to Christina Costa about Fort Fest 2009. Spin that music, Dirk.
We're drinking non-stop. Some whiskey, some vodka.
Live internet radio, it's Sounds of the Bazaar, and Christina Costa's not there at the moment. But never mind, because I can tell you about Fort Fest 2009. Well, what's Fort Fest? Well, it's a two-day event being organised by Pontedusky with the support of the JISC Evolve Network and the European Mature IP Project. And what we're aiming to do is just to bring together researchers in technology-enhanced learning in an open forum to talk about current issues surrounding educational technology, to discuss how and where research impacts on practice and where practice drives research. Now, that's the posh bit, but I suppose the main thing is it's supposed to be a participative event. We really want it to be Web 2-ish, I suppose. People themselves come along with their ideas very unconferency and drive it. So it's based around what people are interested in. We've got a limited number of places on it. We've got money to pay accommodation for people. It's being held in Salford, that's near Manchester in the UK. We can pay for accommodation, we pay for food for those who want to participate face to face. You have to get yourself somehow to Manchester. And we're working on the best technologies to link up the face to face event online using a blended technique, I suppose. So we see it as really as an opportunity to meet and collaborate with people doing the same stuff as you, especially in an international group. Hope very much that you'll think about coming. If you want to, get in touch with Christina Costa or myself and we'll give you details. Have to get fairly fast because I think we've only got about another 10 places left. So that's one thing going on. We've got Fort Fest going on. But a few more events coming up as well in the future. We're organising our regular series of Evolve seminars, online free online seminars. Bit of a difference in this spring because we're doing them jointly with the German EduCamp, and it's really good to be working with that joint organisation between people in different countries coming together around the seminars. Had a fantastic turnout last week, 60 people turned up. Now the next one's on careers. Careers and the Internet. How does Web 2.0 impact on our online reputation and identity? Featuring a couple of inputs from Steve Warburton from the Rezomes Project and Maria Grobholtz from My Online ID, and he's CEO of a German startup company. March the 16th, we got Enterprise 2.0. Potential of using social software for e-learning in enterprises. Speakers lined up at the moment. We've got Timothy Hall from the University of Limerick in Ireland, who I've been friends with for years. Great speaker, and we'll be announcing his second speaker soon. Those are all free events. We use the Illuminate platform, and we'll post you URLs about how to come along to those. We've got the Thought Fest I've already told you about in Manchester. And of course, we got EduCamp 09, which is being held from April the 17th to the 19th. I'm going to probably mispronounce this totally. Ilmenau in South Germany. It's a sort of bar camp type organization looking at how we can use social software for learning. I know I'm pretty impressed with the people running it. It's a very bottom-up organisation behind it. They haven't got a lot of money, but they've got some great ideas. And once more, we'll post you links to how you can get involved in that event. And of course, we've got a series of Sounds of the Bazaars lined up for you. We'll probably have our regular February programme. I haven't quite got a date on that, or I don't think I have. Then in March, we're running two live programmes. Live from a Users Innovation Programme event in Loughborough in the UK. First one's going to be a bit of a social type event. You heard the doorbell. That's my friend Jenny Hughes returning back. This is really live radio. And the second one, we're going to do a bit of a game show format. Now, we'll come back with more details on that in a bit. But we've got a lot of fun we're planning here. I suppose that's nearly it. A few credits to run. First of all, the music. Great music tonight. The band's called Drunk Souls. The style is rock reggae. They're a French band. And their album name, if you want to find them, is On Verra Plus Tard. And you can find their music, like all the music we play on Sounds of the Bazaar, is licensed under Creative Commons license, and it's found on www.yamendo, that's J-A-M-E-N-D-O, yamendo.com. Brilliant site, support Creative Commons, support the music, and support the musicians who put their music on that site. Thanks to everyone. Thanks to the people who agreed to be interviewed for the Dragon's Den. Thanks to all those of you who came in on the chat, brilliant chat tonight. And hey, that quality was incredible. And last and by no means least, thanks to Christina Costa for running the chat room. And when I had a quick peep at it, it looked pretty damn busy. And thanks to Dirk Stierglitz, the producer, without which this programme wouldn't take place. And of course, thanks to you, the listeners, for listening. Sounds of the Bazaar is a Ponta Dusky production for the JISC Users and Innovation Emerge program. Sounds of the Bazaar is produced in the Ponta Dusky studios. The presenter is Graham Maxwell, the producer is Dirk Stierglitz. Sounds of the Bazaar is licensed under a Creative Commons 3 license.
Très bien fait.